Hello and welcome to the Choreo Crime Podcast. I'm your host, Kate, and today we will be discussing the crimes of Yoo Young-chul, also known as the Raincoat Killer. Yoo is a self-confessed serial killer, sex offender, and a self-confessed cannibal who admitted to killing over 20 people. Yoo Young-chul was born on the 18th of April in 1970 in Gocheong County in the North Jeolla Province in the southwest of Korea. His childhood was filled with poverty. His parents were blue-collar workers and had money problems. He was mostly raised with his siblings by his grandmother and was often bullied in school for being poor. Yoo was no stranger to crime. Before he committed murder, he was convicted of theft, forgery, identity theft, and rape. In 1988 and 1991, Yoo was convicted of theft. The latter, he was sentenced to 10 months in prison. In 1993, after his marriage to his girlfriend, he was convicted again for theft and sentenced to 8 months in prison. 4 years after his son was born, in 1994, Young-chul was again convicted of more crimes, including theft and identity theft, for which he served 2 years. In 2000, he was convicted for sexual abuse, rape, and again was back in prison for 3 years and 6 months. At this point, you must be wondering, why is he being released after all these convictions? The answer is not clear, but we can assume the answer lies in the intricacies of the Korean justice system. By September of 2003, Yoo's sentence for rape was finished, and he was released from prison on the 11th of September. It was only 13 days later when he made his first kills. His victims were an elderly couple, Lee Deok-soo, age 72, who is a professor, and his wife, Leono, age 67, in Gangnam-gu in Seoul. He broke into their house and stabbed the professor in the neck and then beat him and his wife with a blunt object. On October 9th, 2003, he committed his second murders. In the bathroom, he killed an 85-year-old woman, Kang Eun-sen, her daughter-in-law, Lee Suk-jin, age 60, who was found in front of the kitchen sink, and her handicapped grandson, Go Jin-so, who was 35. He was found on the second floor. One of the KCSI officers, the Korean crime scene investigators, Kim Hee-suk, described the crime scene as extremely gruesome. All of the victims' heads were dented by a blunt object, and there was blood everywhere. On the first floor, forensics was able to lift two faint footprints from the scene. Police originally suspected the husband, Ko Jung-won, a successful businessman, but he seemed generally upset about their deaths, and they didn't find any evidence to arrest him. They even compared his shoes to the footprints they found at the scene. They also investigated those around him in case anyone held any resentment against him, but no one was found. No angry ex-business partners, no begrudged women from an extramarital affair, no one. Everyone believed he was a hardworking, considerate, and humble person. Investigators also quickly dismissed the idea that this crime was a theft gone wrong. This was because in the bedroom, there was a closet with three drawers that held money and valuables, all which were not taken. Police began noticing suspicious people lingering outside the crime scene. It turned out to be police officers from another division in Gangnam because they had a similar murder that occurred in another area called Shinsa-dong. On October 16, 2003, a 60-year-old woman, Yoo Jun-hee, was found by her son. She had been beaten by a blunt object. Investigators searched the scene for any evidence and noticed an outdoor AC unit, which they examined. And there they found a faint shoe print. They compared it to the one they found in the case before, and it matched. In Haehwa-dong in Jongno-gu, on the 18th of November, 2003, police were called to another murder. This time, an 87-year-old man and his housekeeper were killed by blunt force trauma, and the house was set on fire. Later, Yoo admitted that he accidentally cut himself trying to open a safe, so he decided to burn down the house to destroy any DNA evidence. Investigators found a matching footprint from the scene and officially connected the murderers, also forming a special investigation team. Police pulled cell phone records of phones that pinged near the scenes, blocked off roads, and conducted random searches on people's in cars. They also ran 24-hour shifts. In a stroke of luck, police were able to find a huge building on the street of the fourth murder had CCTV. This was used to monitor the employees entering and leaving the building. On the CCTV, they saw a man walking by. The family was then asked if they could recognize the man. They couldn't, but they did recognize one thing. They recognized the jacket that the suspect was wearing. It was the husband's jacket, the man that was murdered. Police immediately knew that this was the person they were looking for. Investigators debated about showing the CCTV footage to the public. They were nervous it would scare the killer. They were nervous it would scare the killer, leading to the killings being stopped, and that the killer would remain forever unknown. Ultimately, the police decided to show the CCTV footage on news outlets, and the killings did stop for a time. On February 9th, 2004, Yu murdered a 47-year-old woman by stabbing her as she was walking home alone. Police believed this fifth murder was the start of a new MO for Yu. They suspected Yu committed what are known as the Seoul Southwestern murders. These occurred in western areas of Seoul, in Shingildong in Yeongdeongbuk-gu, Bongcheon-dong in Gwanak-gu, Gumcheon-gu, and Doksan-dong. Women who were walking alone in the dark were attacked with a knife or a blunt weapon and were killed. Investigators wondered why the killer's pattern changed from breaking in and killing in private residences to attacking randomly in public spaces. Was his old MO not thrilling enough for him anymore? Or could there be two active serial killers? This last possibility was a possibility, but the chances were very rare. During 1999 to 2000s, although prostitution was illegal, just like it is today, it was very rampant. This was mostly due to corrupt police officers who often turned a blind eye. Brothel owners and police officers became close, some officers taking bribes, and sometimes the brothel owners would give information to police. When Kim Kang-ja, the first female police chief in Korea, was appointed, she began a crackdown on prostitution. She wanted to help the sex workers. She knew many of the girls were tricked or abducted into sex work. At that time, many sex workers began to go missing. Like many places in the world, sex workers often go missing without anyone batting an eye. However, the people that did notice the sex workers were missing were, of course, the pimps and the brothel owners. They knew some girls would run away from time to time, but it began to make them suspicious. In Mapo-gu, Yu began calling sex workers and luring them to his apartment. He often made them instant ramen noodles, and when they went into the bathroom, he killed them by hitting them on the head with the weapon he kept on a shelf. Yu lived on the third floor of his apartment building, so he needed to find a way to get the bodies out of his apartment without anyone noticing. He decided to dismember their bodies, often removing their heads, hands, etc., then disposing of them in a plastic bag. Decomposing bodies have a horrible smell. Yu knew this, and in order to keep the smell from arousing suspicions from his neighbors, he put kimchi in the bags. For those who don't know, kimchi is a traditional Korean dish made from fermented cabbage and Korean radish with Korean chili pepper. It is especially known to have a very strong smell. So much so that in Korea, many people have a specific fridge to keep the kimchi in. After, he would take a taxi to dispose of the bodies. Whenever a taxi driver asked what the smell was, he would explain it was his mother's kimchi that had gone rotten. One night, a brothel owner received a call that would change Yu's life. The owner recognized the number of a sex worker from his brothel that went missing. At first, he thought she ran away, but with this call, he became very suspicious. This brothel owner became an important informant for the police. The owner called a regional police officer who he knew, and they waited for the caller to call again. In order to catch this person, they decided to use a woman and set a meetup with the caller. However, when the woman met the man sent her away saying she was too tall for him. Later, Yu admitted it would have been too hard for him to dispose of her. He often wouldn't try and kill larger women for this reason. He then called another girl to meet him in an alleyway where a police officer followed, but then left soon after. Yu was apprehended by the employees of a massage parlor, often where prostitution occurs, where the police were able to arrest Yu. After his arrest, forensics and fellow investigators went to Yu's apartment to find evidence to charge him. At this point, they didn't have any evidence, only suspicions. They needed to find the murder weapon. That was Baesang Hoon, Korea's profiling master's focus from early on. Now they knew it was the same weapon in the Baekhyun murders, their murders from September to November 2003, and his recent murders of the sex workers. It was the one and same. Near his apartment, they found a sledgehammer, which they thought could be the weapon. However, it was difficult to determine Near his apartment, they found a sledgehammer, which they thought could be the weapon. However, it didn't have any blood on it. They searched all over his apartment to find any DNA evidence. It was described by one investigator as spotless. His apartment was really clean. Even the bathroom looked pristine. This caused the forensic team and the investigators to become suspicious. The forensic team decided to spray luminol, a substance which reacts with iron and blood. They spread it all over the bathroom. There were blood splatters everywhere, including the ceiling. Later, they found a sledgehammer with a shorter handle than the one that they found outside. At first, it seemed there was no blood on it, but when they took it apart and scraped it, there were traces of blood. This was because blood clots very easily, and it's very hard to get rid of after it clots. You had obviously not cleaned this one very well. You had customized his own weapon to make it fit in his hand easier. He also had many tools around, as he would often use them for work. To others, it would not seem suspicious. You did not deny the allegations against him and immediately confessed to 19 murders, but eventually he confessed to killing 26. The investigator who was interviewing you brought in a piece of paper to take notes. You asked him to give him the piece of paper and the pen, and you made tally marks on the paper. The investigator asked him what the marks were for. You said the tally marks represented the number of people he murdered. In the interview room, you faked an epileptic seizure because police would then uncuff him. They uncuffed him because they didn't want him harmed in their custody during a medical incident. They were also waiting to take him to the crime scenes so you could confirm the details what the police already knew. However, one of the officers that was left in charge of you went to go get the van and other officers ready, leaving you alone in the room. Unbeknownst to him, you followed him out of the room. In the hallway, other officers thought that you was being led somewhere else in the building by the officer that was looking after him. So they didn't suspect anything was wrong. You found the stairs and escaped out of the police station. The police were terrified that he would kill again and needed to rearrest him as soon as possible. How could they have let a killer like him escape? The chief of the mobile investigation unit assembled all 100 officers that went combing through all the alleyways and streets in the area. You later admitted he went to see his mother and sister and changed his clothes. He then dumped any evidence that he had into the garbage. While you was out walking free to kill again, an officer went to the prosecutor in charge and asked him for release papers for you, claiming it was for a small theft case. You did in fact steal a cell phone, but this was to cover up the embarrassment of the fact that they let a heinous murderer go free. When the prosecutor refused, the officer told the prosecutor the truth, knowing that if they did not find you soon, they would be in trouble for falsifying documents. Luckily for the officer and the prosecutor, 12 hours later, you was spotted crossing the street by officers. They surrounded him and rearrested him. Again, you was interviewed, and investigators took him to the crime scenes to confirm the details of the murders. At first, you told them all the wrong details, positions of bodies, how he did it, etc. This was later determined to be a ploy to determine what the police knew. Later, you confirmed what the investigators had found at the scenes. Police took him to where he disposed of the bodies. You marked the burial sites with things like bottle caps to help him remember where he buried the victims. He only used one place to dispose of the victims because it would have been too hard for him to remember them all. He buried the bodies in a place he knew well, in a forest behind Bonglong Temple. The next day, they took a disguised you, who was wearing a mask, a hat, and a yellow raincoat, back to the burial site with the forensic team. And there were many reporters. They found the bodies of 18 victims, all in pieces. They numbered them and pieced all the bodies together. Police didn't think that they could identify the victims by using the fingerprints to the body's conditions. And they would have to wait for DNA analysis, which would take time. However, Kim Hee-suk, a forensic officer at the Seoul Metropolitan Police, refused to give up. And eventually, she got all victims identified in the same day by meticulously and continuously using their fingers. In Yoo's confession, he admitted to many horrific things. He not only mutilated the bodies for ease of disposing them, but also to increase the difficulty in identification of the victims if they were ever found. In his apartment, police found a toilet paper roll, something not out of the ordinary in a bathroom. Here's already knew from you what he used it for. When they found the victims' heads, they would find their hair tied up with elastic bands. You admitted that he would tie their hair up and hang them to drain the blood. You also confessed that he ate the livers of some of his victims. However, this was never confirmed. So why did Yoo Young-chul do it? Many, including Bae Sang-hoon, wanted to know. In Korea, after the arrival of responding officers to crime scenes, five crime scene investigators from KCSI and a criminal profiler are dispatched to their scenes. The forensic team focuses on the physical evidence, and the profiler tries to find the motive and psychological aspects of the killer so they can better catch them. It is believed that Yoo's motives for killing his elderly victims in wealthy areas was due to his childhood poverty and his victims' wealth. By killing sex workers, he acted upon his dislike for women. Now, when Yoo was in his late 20s, Korea's currency took a downward turn, and this caused a devastating financial crisis, also known as the IMF crisis. The Korean government contacted the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, for help. The $60 billion bailout came with conditions that forced Korea to make restructuring policies and programs. These included flexibility in terminating employees, increased flexibility of exchange rates, and tightening of monetary policy. It also forced Korea to raise interest rates, liberalize trades, and stop Korean conglomerates from expanding to stop inflation and increasing foreign reserves. This led to many workers losing their jobs and becoming homeless. The gap between the rich and poor widened and created hostility among the poor. This also led to increased assault cases and the rise of kidnappings for high ransoms. In addition, prosecutors believe Yoo's divorce from his wife in October of 2007 and a failed relationship with a sex worker was the reason he killed many sex workers, including masseuses and prostitutes. While being interviewed, Kim Hee-suk, a female forensic officer, was brought in to establish details from Yoo's confession. At this point, Yoo refused to talk, and she was sent out of the room to listen from outside. Then Yoo started talking. Yoo himself admitted that he killed women because he hated them. And on TV, he said, "Women shouldn't be sluts, and the rich should know what they've done." Yoo Young-chul's case caused a lot of fear in people across Korea. It also caused a lot of controversy over the death penalty and an incident that happened to the mother of a victim. The mother blamed the police for taking so long to catch Yoo. Police were escorting Yoo to the prosecutor's office when she tried to attack Yoo with an umbrella, and a police officer then kicked the woman as his hands were holding onto Yoo. Later, police apologized and the officer was reprimanded. On December 13, 2004, Yoo was sentenced to death, which he accepted. In Korea, the death penalty is legal. However, there has been a moratorium or pause on the death penalty since February 1998. So many criminals who have a death sentence have not been executed. The last execution in Korea was carried out in 1997, and so Yoo remains in prison at Seoul Prison to this day. On the other hand, some positives have come out of Yoo's case. During Yoo's murders, Korea didn't have a DNA database for former convicts. Therefore, they didn't have Yoo's fingerprints. After his murders, Korea began thinking that having a DNA database like the US would help them tremendously when catching criminals, especially repeat offenders. Also, since his spree, there was an internal investigation of the Mobile Investigation Unit, which captured Yoo. Policies and procedures were changed, and detective training skills were increased. Now many criminals are apprehended a lot faster, and the city of Seoul has a solve rate for murder, which is around 97 to 98.5%. I have lived in South Korea for over 5 years now, 3 years in Seoul and 2 years in the Seoul metropolitan area. And I know crime exists here, but I truly feel safe. At one of my old apartments at night, I would often go for a walk to release stress or to help me sleep. I was never once approached or attacked. I believe these officers and the lessons the police have learned over the years are the ones who make this country so safe. When researching this case, I found myself wondering what life would have been like during Yoo's killing spree and how scared everyone must have been. I am truly lucky that I live in a safer Korea. So that is it for the case of Yoo Young-chul. I will be posting my resources for this case and other cases in the description of the episodes. Later, I will be posting it on a website when it is launched. Thank you so much for listening to the Koryo Crime Podcast, and I hope you continue to join me in exploring more crimes and mysteries in Korea. Bye!